RFN episode 328. I am your at least interim host, James Jones. As you can hear from the fact that you are listening to my dulcet tones, Johnny Metz isn't here. He was supposed to be here 10 minutes ago and he still hasn't shown. But that's okay because the important people are here this week. If he shows up, whatever. But let's introduce the people who really matter. Mr. Guillaume Veillette.
Sleep deprived but happy.
Fantastic. And that guy over there.
This week, I will be answering your questions about space.
Oh, great. Thank you, Johnny. So we're going to try out something new with new business this week. Not getting into too much details. Let's just say it's been running a little bit long lately. So we're going to attempt a round-robin format for games. This isn't a hard and fast rule, but for this week, we're going to try it out, where everybody gets to talk about a game, and then we roll back around, and hopefully we won't go forever this week. So we're going to go ahead and start this week with Guillaume, who has a thing to talk about that is like a saga, I suppose. Smooth.
A saga. A bit trip saga. Yeah, I wasn't on this podcast back when these games originally came out for WiiWare, but for those who don't know, I'm a huge, huge bit trip fan. Mostly of Runner, but, you know, the whole series was pretty good. And I don't usually buy games twice, you know, the ones that I still have the means to play. I don't really like purchasing several ports of the same game, but recently Bit Trip Saga for the 3DS was on sale on the eShop.
Part of the digital sales promotions.
Yeah, the plentiful sales that we always constantly get from Nintendo.
And, one at a time. Get in line.
So, for just $10, you know, I thought, well, why not? You know, it might be a good thing to have on hand at all times, sitting on my 3DS, you know, to play at a moment's notice. But I hadn't played these games in a long time, and I had forgotten just how unfriendly they were to short play sessions. I don't know why, but I kind of remember them as... you know, they're downloadable, so they're probably pretty short, pretty well-suited to quick play. But then I start playing the first game, Bit Trip Beat, and the first level just won't end. It goes on and on and on and on for like 6-7 minutes. I didn't time it, but...
It is interminable, yes.
It is, and if you blink, you're dead. So yeah. Try keeping your eyes open for like 7 minutes.
Yeah. With the 3D pounding them.
Yeah, not exactly made for playing on the train or the bus. It'd be about the worst thing ever to play.
I do recall when I reviewed this game noting that a lot of it felt like it just didn't fit well on the handheld.
Yeah. And, so that was kind of a surprise.
Real quick, Guillaume, sorry to cut you off, but although I already said that the important people are here, the rest of the plebeians have decided to show up, and that Johnny Metz is now with us.
Hello.
Yes. Yes, we were discussing that the game doesn't really suit itself well to some mobile, or to the mobile play sessions in some cases.
Yeah, and so I'm actually kind of regretting the purchase already.
It's $10!
Oh, sure, but I don't see, you know, I don't see myself really going to it instead of other games when I'm playing on the go. I also got Crashmo on sale, and that's probably going to be the go-to game. On the subway, on the train.
Don't you think the whole value of Bit Trip Saga is having a portable version of Runner?
Yeah.
Because that's the one that could actually work as a portable game, because it's broken up into these 2 or 3 minute stages. And I've also heard that the 3D effect is the best on that game too, which makes sense because it has actual backgrounds.
Right. There is something to be 3D against.
Yeah.
I've been spoiled by the 3D effect and the Nicolas games, you know, like Night Sky and Ika-chan looked so pretty with the 3D on, and I just don't think that's the case with these Bit Trip games, even Runner. They get a little bit annoying to play with the 3D on because there's the frame rate noticeably gets worse.
Oh yeah, that's totally unacceptable.
Yeah, that is a problem. And even worse, like, I had heard from some people, yeah, they, you know, don't turn the 3D on because of the frame rate. But in Runner, like, right now I'm playing stage 111, the infamous stage 111. And as soon as you get more than, like, three obstacles or, like, two obstacles and gold bars on the screen at the same time, there are also frame rate problems. The game chugs.
That sucks.
For an instant there, I thought, oh, maybe I somehow pushed the slider. Maybe the 3D is on. And then I actually pushed the slider, and hey, the frame rate is halved again. So, you know.
Wow. See, I don't remember seeing it like that. When I reviewed the game. I don't remember experiencing frame rate chunkiness as bad as Guillaume has apparently experienced. So I'm a bit surprised to hear it. I mean, yeah, it did. It was slower frame rate when you had the 3D on, but it wasn't unplayable, and it seemed pretty stable when I was doing it. It just wasn't, you know.
Well, maybe like it was kind of an early release on the 3DS.
Yeah, it was.
I think a lot of 3DS games early on kind of had, you know, so frame rate, and they've gotten better recently, in my opinion.
Yeah.
So maybe I'm just not used to that anymore. But also, like, I just played the demo for Runner 2, which is smooth, it's incredible, and it's so beautiful, and, like, just the contrast there is also makes it worse. But in the end, like, the fact is that I'm not sure if I'm gonna be really playing that game on the go all that much, and when I'm home, well, I'm gonna go through the hassle of turning on Wii mode, and I'm gonna play, on the Wii, because, you know, the games are better there.
Yeah.
So, I don't know. Like, I'm disappointed. I'm glad to support Gaijin games as much as, you know, in any way I can, but it's just not a very good version of those games.
I mean, the thing for me is that you do get all the games, but when I mentioned this when I did the review, a lot of the games feel really duplicative. You know, if you played, what is it, Flux and... I'm trying to remember what the one that's like Flux.
Beat.
Yeah, if you play Beat, and then you go play Flux, you're like, well, this is just like a level... later in the game of Beat.
It's, I mean, they're bookends. They're meant to be mirrors of each other, but they're also not meant to be played back to back. They're meant to be played with all those other ones in between.
Yeah, and like those two games, like there was what, like a 1 year interval at least between them?
Oh, probably more than that.
I think it's about 2 years, yeah.
Yeah. But yeah, like I can imagine that they feel very similar, but the rest of them, like there's a lot of variety there. I was playing Void, which I also really like, and that one controlled well in the 3DS, and probably it's going to be one of the games that I go the most back to. The frame rate didn't annoy me there, but also the stages were still pretty long, and I don't know.
Void and Runner were my favorite experiences with the 3DS compilation.
Mm-hmm.
Void is kind of weird because of how it uses the 3D effect, because there's not much to 3D against.
No.
So they just took the primary, really what is effectively your cursor,
mm-hmm.
and just like glued it to the very top of the screen and pushed everything else back.
Right.
So it's a couple other things do that on 3DS, and when you have a black background with something pressed right up against the top of the screen, it almost gives the impression that it's levitating off the top of the screen. It's the only real way to simulate kind of a 3D where it's actually coming out of the screen.
Yeah.
And it actually makes it look really kind of cool.
So yeah, those are all my thoughts. All of them. All
right.
Okay. So I guess that means, according to the notes, that Johnny is up next.
Yay. So I played a game called You, Me, and the Cubes on WiiWare. And I got this for free from Club Nintendo probably at least a year ago, I think. And then... I kind of put it away for a rainy day on new business. Never ended up playing it. It's always been kind of there. It was one of the things I brought over, you know, with the Wii U, and actually had it on my system memory because I wanted it to be available. It was like almost as a reminder, hey, play this next whenever you decide to play
it. Cube it up!
Yeah. And yet, it just, I never really got around to it. So,
you, me, and the no cubes.
Unfortunately, the rainy day that made me pull this out and start playing it is a very sad event. The game's creator, Kenji Ino, passed away a couple weeks ago, as you might have heard elsewhere and maybe read about him. I've never played one of his games before this. I don't know a whole lot about the guy. It just kind of reminded me that, oh yeah, I should really go play You, Me, and the Cubes, the game that I got for free a year ago. And so I did. I popped it in there, really not remembering a whole lot about it from when it first came out back in 2009. I remembered that it got pretty good reviews and that I was curious about it at the time, but it was, you know, 10 or 12 bucks and just I wasn't sure. There was no demo for it. And at the time, I just passed on it. So anyway, fast forward to now, and I'm finally catching up with it, and actually really like it. It's a very, very cool little game. It's really a puzzle game, very straightforward, kind of like action puzzle game. It's broken up into a lot of different levels, and it reminds me a lot of like a kind of, it's almost like a bonus mode to Boom Blocks. So it's not a mini game, but it feels like, you know, Boom Blocks has a lot of different modes, and it feels like this could have been one of the better modes in a Boom Blocks game. Because it controls very similarly. You have this cube floating in the middle of the screen. It's kind of out in, you know, the blackness of space, and it's sort of slowly rotating, but you can control the camera actually. So you can spin it around if you find that that helps. And you're pointing at the screen. Well, actually, first you shake the controller to fill it up with your follows, which are the little guys that you're trying to stick to the cube. And once they're in there, the controller rumbles. And that provides this really interesting kind of feedback loop between the motion control and you knowing when your motion has actually, you know, achieved the desired effect. It also plays a sound. So from the very beginning, my very first experience with this was, you know, shake the controller until it fills up with these little guys. And I felt that they made a really very astute use of the controller features by using the rumble and also the sound to let you know when you've done it correctly. So that lets you know that you can stop shaking. And it doesn't take very much, but it's still it's a very good idea. And then you point it at the screen, just like in Boom Blocks, and you have a cursor, and you point where you want to throw these guys, and you always throw them in a pair. So you always have to place two dots on the screen. And once you do that, you just fling the remote forward like in Boom Blocks, and your little dudes swing out there on the screen. And when they do, they land on this cube and they stand up, and then the cube starts to kind of rebalance based on the distribution of mass from where you've thrown them. And the thing that makes it a challenge is that after you know, basically your goal is to get a certain number of these little guys on there without the cube tipping over, and then it'll have this kind of 2-second judging period where it makes sure that none of them are about to fall off. And then you've passed that level. But the trick is then they add another cube to it. And these cubes are all interconnected, so they're all adjoined. The cubes are kind of inside of each other. They're attached, basically.
Yeah, they become less and less regular, basically.
Yeah, right. So they get very asymmetrical, and in order to pass the level, not only do you have to throw whatever the minimum number of little guys is, and it can be as many as 10 or 12 or 14 little guys. So it could be quite a few of them, which means that the mass is very hard to kind of predict in your head, you know, before you actually see how the thing goes. But as these structures, these of cubes that you're trying to throw them on become more complicated and bigger, you also have to have at least one guy on each cube. So if there's 6 or 7 cubes that are all attached to each other, you can't just throw all the guys into the one in the middle because that's where it's easiest to balance them. You have to put at least one into all these kind of outcropped, outlying kind of cubes that are really not in a good place. Like sometimes they'll be way out on the edge, or they'll just be in this weird place where it's clear if you throw a guy on there, it's going to throw the whole thing off balance and it's going to screw you, but you have to. So you have to kind of think in your head, how do I get a guy on that face where he's required and put the other one somewhere else where it'll kind of at least partially balance him out? And you have to do all this very quickly because there's a time limit. So it's a very interesting game. It's very much physics-based in a way that I haven't really seen any other physics-based puzzle game. It's quick-paced, very quirky and funny.
Like you've got your little guys, like once they start sliding off, they just hang on to the ledge and the other ones will try to reach him and try to pull him back. And, you know, you feel for these little guys, really.
Yeah, it has that almost Pikmin effect of, you know, these little guys, they are kind of consumable and throwaway, but they're animated in such a way that you really feel responsible for them. And they will die. They will fall off. And when they do, they say things like, "Aye!" or, my favorite was the guy who was about to fall off, and he said, "Why?" It's very funny. It's very quirky and weird. You know, the music is kind of drony electronic type stuff, sort of ambient music. And I guess that's what Kenji Ino was kind of famous for. I'm guessing that's why his name is, you know, translated the way that it is. Because I was reading an article that Chris Kohler wrote about him, and it said that his name normally would be translated, the spelling would be transliterated I-I-N-O, but Eno, yet everyone always wrote it E-N-O. So I'm thinking that must be, you know, because as some kind of tribute to Brian Eno, the electronic music composer. So I think that's kind of what he was going for. I think that was sort of his style. And I don't know fully the extent of his involvement in the design of this game or the artwork or anything else. But I think in addition to being a well-known music composer for video games, I think Kenji Ino also was involved in the design of a lot of this stuff.
He was. So I mean, this was his game. So he made it with, he made it with, Nishi, the guy who worked on Chibi-Robo and Captain Rainbow. But yeah, so he was involved in the design of this game. He actually founded another company before Phyto where they made, and John, get ready, they made 3DO games.
Yeah,
Warp. Yes. It makes it all worthwhile. So they paid their dues.
They also made Saturn games and, PlayStation games. They were pretty well known back then. They made the horror game D, which I don't know that it's actually good, but I know that it has this weird cult following, kind of like Deadly Premonition.
It's a bit Kusoge. A bit.
Yeah, yeah. I always got that sense.
I feel like this guy is someone who I would prefer to read the Wikipedia pages of his games than actually play them. You know, D is actually like you're
in some cases,
being followed by an invisible monster at all times,
like
tracking you. Yeah. I don't know if that sounds fun, but it sure sounds interesting.
It sounds like a quick way of preventing you from having to render an evil monster.
Yeah.
Saving dem polygons!
Yeah, I think Kenji Ino was more beloved than he was great as a game designer, you know? I don't know that his games are all that amazing, but I think he was just a very likable guy, and a lot of people really admired him for being kind of out there and being very independently minded. Anyway, this is the only thing I can judge him on. This is the only one of his games that I've played, but I think Yumi and the Cubes is surprisingly very good. And if you're a big fan of Boom Blocks, I would certainly recommend it. If you're looking for a kind of a two-player puzzle game for the Wii, I actually, because I enjoyed the writing of the tutorial character so much when I went through the tutorial, I think the localization's fantastic for this little character, really laugh out loud funny. And so I said, I want to watch the two-player tutorial, even though I don't even have anybody else here to play this with me. And I did, and it wasn't quite as funny as the single-player, but I was exposed to how the game works in two-player mode. It's actually a very different game. And there's a lot of special features and changes to the rules when you play a two-player. And it made me think, I would actually love to try this in two-player mode. It seems very, very interesting. So, you know, if you're looking for something to play on your Wii U or your Wii, I mean, this is a WiiWare game. I don't think it's all that expensive. I would definitely recommend checking it out sometime. I was pretty impressed by it.
I think it's 1,000 points.
Okay. Yeah, it's not that much, and there is a lot of content to it. I mean, I was kind of scrambling through because, you know, based on the game's aesthetics and the fact that it is just these cubes, you know, there's not a whole lot of variety in the level geometry that they challenge you with. I was wondering, how do they ramp this up? Because there's, I think, 40 or 50 levels to choose from on the main menu. And I thought, this seems like it would get really repetitive. So I started jumping around a little bit, and they actually they don't introduce different shapes or anything that I can tell, but they do introduce a lot of special cubes. So sometimes the level will kind of pulse and shock the guys that you throw on. So you have to be really careful with the timing of when you throw them on there.
Sometimes it's on fire.
Sometimes the cubes freeze for a moment after you attach characters to it, which means it'll stop spinning and it'll stop rebalancing, which is actually helpful. So there's a lot, they're not really power-ups, but there's special features in the levels that start to come up. Some of them make it more difficult, some of it make it a little bit easier, but then it's balanced out by them giving you a stricter time limit or asking you to throw even more characters on there. So it seems like they did a pretty respectable job of, you know, giving it some variety. Yeah, it seems like a really cool game. So, James, you're up next for new business with a game that we have recently discussed, but not really talked about on the show yet.
I've been usurped.
Awkward.
So, when Billy was on the show a couple weeks ago, he graciously offered myself, and actually John, who I don't know that he's been given it yet, codes to download his the game that he worked on, Skulls of the Shogun. which is, we talked about it a bit. It's a turn-based strategy RPG-ish kind of game. It has kind of the vibe of a lot of the turn-based strategy console games that we've talked about when we did that particular episode, mm-hmm. but it's not grid-based. There's not really a lot of character progression. There's a little bit. There's not like a super complicated weapons triangle. It's a very kind of slimmed down version of that genre.
So would you say it's more Advance Wars than Fire Emblem?
Yeah. There's a lot less RPG to it than Fire Emblem.
Yeah, and there is resource management. I mean, it's more like it's kind of hard to describe because it's not really Fire Emblem because there is resource management. You can produce units. But all the battles are really small. I mean, even some of the later ones, I mean, they're bigger, but it's not like you're never going to have like 40-on-40 fighting. It's usually somewhere in the 8s to 10s is kind of where it caps out. Basic premise is you are a dead shogun who has been transported to the afterlife and has decided that he wants to take it over. That's pretty much it. You and your army of skeletons then go on a rampage and eat skulls for power-ups. Finn. I mean, that's pretty much the game in a nutshell. You can control your characters. You get a certain number of moves per turn. It's not everybody gets a move. It's like it's 5, and so you have to kind of, understand how you're going to manage the various moves you get per turn. You can produce units. You can collect resources. Sometimes you're granted special units that have magic powers. It's not like a super deep strategy game. It's a little bit more approachable. It feels faster, although occasionally it can get kind of bogged down. It's really driven by, I mean, there's a lot of presentation drive on it, so it's really, there's a lot of comedy involved in the game. You know, the whole thing is kind of a joke in and of itself. I mean, it's, all the characters are really weird and silly, because they're dead skeleton warriors, whatever. I don't know, I'm trying to figure out the best way to describe it. I mean, I just go to how I feel about the game. I mean, I'm enjoying it so far. I'm probably about 60% in, I think, so a percentage you said last time.
Oh wow!
So I've got a little bit of ground left to cover. It's not super difficult, especially if you're this is traveled ground to you. A lot of the times, it feels a bit different than most strategy games because there's not like a concrete. Well, you either go or you hold and wait for the enemy to come to you thing. You kind of have to manage it based on the level layouts, which actually have things like obstacles in there that affect the ability to fight and your ability to move.
But it's like the view is from overhead, right?
Yeah.
It's not like Valkyria Chronicles or anything like that.
No. The movement is similar to Valkyria because in Valkyria Chronicles, your characters kind of have a radius that they can move within.
Right.
And they can move around and attack anywhere within that radius. And once they move and attack, their turn is over and the next person can go. But they don't limit you to having to move on some kind of path or some grid-based system. So it feels like – sometimes it feels like you have more mobility and you can get around the environment a little more creatively than you can in some grid-based games.
Right.
Yeah. And in fact, that's – a lot of times your objective isn't just eliminate the enemy, although – a lot of times it's either kill the enemy samurai or the enemy shogun, rather. Or it's just get to a certain spot on the map. And a lot of times that means you can sort of maybe lead the enemy one way and then take a shortcut around them and avoid most of the fighting. There are little tricks you can use the environment and the movement system for to kind of help you strategize. And really, a lot of the strategy in the game is more in how you move your forces around than it is the individual combat, because there's really only a handful of types of units, so there's not a lot of that going on. It's much more about how you position and how you move and how you flow through the level to the objective. Like I said, I'm enjoying it so far. I didn't really feel I was getting pressed until about the third section of the game, because it's broken up in like sets of like 4 or 5 battles. And there the game actually started to stack things against you. I'm curious how the game is going to continue to progress the difficulty curve up, because so far it feels, pretty relatively straightforward to get through. So I'm curious if they're just going to resort to putting more enemies on the screen, or they're going to contrive situations that are even less amenable to your progression.
Well, it was originally conceived as a multiplayer game, and the campaign stuff was done later. So I think if it feels not super challenging or something like that, that probably has something to do with it.
Probably.
And I would imagine if Billy was here, he would say that if you think the campaign is too easy, either crank up the difficulty or go play multiplayer against a human, because it's, you know, that's where you're going to have the real competition.
I am actually looking forward to getting to the multiplayer, but as the general rule for Xbox Live Arcade games, I don't go into multiplayer until I've at least gotten through the campaign, because otherwise I will be the dead.
Yeah, I'll play with you.
Yeah, that sounds good.
That'd be fun.
Like I said, I'm pushing my way through it. I like playing, you know, because the missions are only about 10 minutes long each. I actually cleared one of them in like 2 minutes just because I realized, oh, I could feint all my units this way and then just walk my Shogun right past all the enemies. So he just made it to the exit in like 3 turns. Didn't fight anybody, just strolled to the exit.
Yep.
And he's like, well, okay, that works.
One thing I learned from Billy, because I was having a lot of trouble on an early mission, whatever the objective is, and usually the objective is kill the enemy commander, you can ignore everyone else. And
pretty
occasionally
much.
It's just get to a certain place, you can ignore literally all the enemies unless they just are blocking your path. But I found that the mission difficulties are really balanced around you focusing on that objective. And if you ignore that objective and say, I just want to kill everyone on this map, it can be insanely hard.
Yep. And because a lot of the reason, because the enemies can usually produce units faster than you can.
Yeah. Or even the missions where no one can produce units, they just outmatch you.
Right.
And so it really does pay to pay attention to the objectives and go for them as hard as you can. And be really aggressive about it.
The only real level up mechanism is the consumption of skulls, mm-hmm. which as each skull you eat, you gain a certain amount of base health. And if you eat 3 of them, you turn into this Oni that can attack twice. And that's pretty much the only real tactical advantages you can put over one-on-one combat. To a certain extent, you can do things like get cover or use archers creatively,
yeah.
But generally speaking, it's going to be pretty much a 1-to-1 loss ratio on open ground.
Mm-hmm.
So it's understanding that and knowing how to move around it that really is how the game forces you to think tactically.
Yeah.
It's in that way, it's much more of a resource management game where it's much more about maneuvering than it is about, you know, the, all right, I'm going to wait right here for them to get to me and then I'm going to drop the trap on them.
I think the main resource you have to manage is your turns, because every turn you get 5 scrolls, basically, and each scroll lets you control one unit. And in most cases, you have more than 5 characters. So you're not going to get to do an action with every one of your units. And so you have to figure out, how am I going to divide up these scrolls in order to move the people I need to move and get in enough attacks to actually make a difference and come out better than I was before. And that's the really critical element to the strategy, I think. And at first it's frustrating because it feels like it takes longer to do things. You know, you can't just move everyone every turn like you can in Advance Wars or Fire Emblem. But as I play more of the game, I'm starting to respect that decision more, because I do think it forces you to be a little more tactical with what you're doing, mm-hmm. rather than just move everyone as a wave, because you just can't afford to do that. The game doesn't let you. So you do kind of have to split people up and move them around very thoughtfully. And the enemy does too. So you sometimes you can use that to your advantage. You can say, well, I'm in a really bad spot in these 3 different places, but I know the enemy's not going to have enough moves to actually take advantage of all that in the same turn. So I'm going to make it through at least one of these. So if you divide your forces up in a certain way, sometimes you can kind of bust through just based on, you know, having spread your forces so thinly that he can't take them all at once.
Yeah, and sometimes you can bait them into wasting turns on a more or less tactically insignificant unit.
That's right, yeah.
And that's really how I beat that one stage. I basically said, all right, here's a bunch of things for you to attack. They don't mean shit. But
you
by all means,
sneak the spy around the end and, you know, sack the quarterback, or whatever metaphor you want to use.
Yeah, waste your 5 moves on this guy. I don't care.
Yeah.
And sometimes the enemy, actually the AI, which what I'm impressed with it is when it just bypasses things that are irrelevant altogether and just goes straight for their target.
Mm-hmm.
But other times, just like, yeah, whatever. Have fun. Yeah, I mean, I enjoy it. I kind of want to see how the game progresses in terms of its difficulty curve. Like, I'd like to see how they're going to make the later missions feel, you know, give you that same sense of growth as sort of that early to middle phase of the game does.
Yeah.
And then eventually I'd like to try it online. But We'll get there.
We will do that. All right. So, John, what do you have for new business this week?
Yeah, I don't have a whole lot of new business this week. I've been playing some more To the Moon, playing some more Pokemon, of course. But really, my new business is something that actually surprised me this week, and it has to do with Black Ops 2. They released, you know, of course, all of their DLC comes out on the 360 first. It's no surprise to anybody. They have an exclusive deal to release it on the 360 first. Well, it came out for the PS3 this week. And what I thought was interesting was that, you see this, you know, there's been like kind of like a burst of news about, hey, you know, Black Ops 2 DLC is coming out on PS3, which brings into question the Wii U. And apparently there is no plan, currently there's no announced plan to bring that same DLC to Wii U, which I find very, very interesting. It actually was really surprising and kind of distressing as well. The fact that, I mean, I would just assume that for this game, they would just be able to crank that DLC out. And this is like, it's a four map pack, right?
Right.
I don't see why they wouldn't release that on all platforms. And it kind of makes me wonder sort of what the deal is. Is the Black Ops 2 community that small on Wii U? It must be. But I don't see why they wouldn't want to service that community just to make some extra money, because I figured that was kind of the whole point of releasing Black Ops 2 on Wii U.
Yeah, it's kind of a chicken and the egg thing. So they've released a version of Black Ops 2 on this console,
which is that very good.
Is intrinsically more expensive than buying Black Ops 2 on any number of systems where it's been out for a while, because all of those have seen price drops. You can buy used copies, etc., etc., etc.
Yeah.
Whereas on Wii U, it is 60 fucking bucks.
I spent 30. I'm sure you
can. That's true.
And
you can
find a used copy on Wii U as well. I mean, there may not be as many to pick from. I'm sure there aren't, but I'm sure you could find it somewhere. But I mean, you know, Best Buy had it for literally half off for a while.
What puzzles me is, I mean, part of their whole model for these games is releasing these map packs, so they can bring in this extra money and prolong the life of the game and prolong the money they make. So it just puzzles me why they would not release the DLC. I'm not expecting it necessarily maybe on the same day as PS3, but just the fact that it didn't come out at all and that there's really no answer as to when it will come out.
Like, could it be that Nintendo is making it unnecessarily complicated to give these options to developers, like for DLC and things like that? Because I played the Runner 2 demo today, and there's no option to, like, just buy the game from the demo.
Sure.
And I don't know if, like, the demo is that way for the other platforms, but you know, that's been an option in every demo on PSN that I've ever played.
I don't know that it's necessarily that, because Nintendo, I mean, seems very much intimately aware of the importance of DLC in this previous console generation as a way to defer the tremendous cost of developing these HD games. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's really a secondary income stream to sort of offset the fact that the budget for producing a Black Ops game is ridiculous.
Yeah.
So, I'm sure they're aware, and Nintendo themselves have spoken about DLC on the Wii U. I can't remember if any game's actually done it yet.
I'm very positive that Black Ops 2 on Wii U has the hooks to do DLC. And I think Nintendo has built the eShop to handle that stuff, for sure.
Sure.
I mean, even the 3DS eShop can handle it, so I know.
Right. I mean, you could buy, 3DS games, you don't even go to the eShop, you buy it from the game.
Yeah. I mean, it's possible that this content might be held up in certification hell or something, but I kind of doubt it. My feeling is probably Activision is not sure whether it's worth the effort based on the install base, and maybe they're just kind of waiting. And, you know, they figure, well, we're not in a huge rush because there aren't that many people playing it online anyway for Wii U. The audience that's committed to playing it on that platform will buy it even if it's late. So we've got nothing to lose. Like, we might as well wait and see if the game picks up any steam. And maybe the people who bought it at the cut rate price a few weeks ago, maybe once they finish the campaign, they will start spending a lot more time online. I mean, I played some online last weekend with Scott Thompson and Justin Barabay and a few other people, and we had a blast. Darkerai was there, some people from our community and some people from the staff, and we were having a really good time. And that game, that was by far the most I've played of it so far. I played it for maybe an hour, and it was a ton of fun. It ran really, really well. I had a little bit of lag, but my Wii U is hooked up over wireless, so I'm not super surprised by that. But it was great. Had a blast, you know. Worked really, really well. It looked fantastic. Had no problem getting into games. You know, we were able to create like a party and then move from, you know, move through the online menus with our group intact. The voice chat worked fantastically well, you know, for everybody who had a headset. So, yeah, no problem at all. I thought it was a very impressive version of the well-known Call of Duty multiplayer that we all know and love or hate.
Yeah. I mean, I was thinking that maybe with the map packs, maybe they're concerned about people being able to download them, you know, with the Wii U only having 32 gigs or whatever. But, I mean, the map packs aren't very large. They're maybe 600 to 800 megs.
Okay. So. Yeah, that shouldn't be a... Especially, I mean, this game in particular is not available on the eShop. So if this is the main thing that you're playing on your Wii U, you probably have plenty of space left.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah. So we are back around to Guillaume. Guillaume, what next game would you like to talk about this week?
Well, I in the intro, I mentioned that I was sleep-deprived, and there's a good reason for that. this week, I was, you know, I was so relieved by the decision that I didn't have to, you know, keep playing Fist of the North Star anymore. I you know, crapped out the review. Then, you know, like I was okay. Tonight I'm finishing Dragon Quest VI. And, so I've been playing that a lot. And of course, you know, I should have known, it's been a while since I even tried to finish an RPG, but I should have remembered that, you know, when you think that you're right at the end, you should at least plan for like an hour or two more.
One more twist.
Yeah.
Because that's probably, you know, you're probably going to end up spending more time on it than you think.
And that's a very Japanese thing anyway. Actually, there's one more boss and he's a motherfucker.
Yeah, because they see that as being a good thing. They think the player is going to be relieved. Oh, good. The game's not over yet. And I think maybe it's a more Western attitude. But usually after 50 hours, when I get to the end of this game, I'm ready for it to end. I just want it to end gracefully.
See, it depends on the game. It depends on the game, though, because Xenoblade pulls that trick a couple times, and it with different levels of surprise. I mean, the first time it pulls it, it's whoa,
yeah,
wait, what?
The first time's okay. There, it does it a couple times later on when I really wish it had just ended.
Thankfully, Dragon Quest VI is not too egregious in that sense, because the boss has like three forms. It's not really the boss that took me a long time. It's just that the step of getting to the boss the first time took a little bit longer than I thought it would. But then, you know, I faced him. I got to his third form. I died. Dragon Quest, though, is lenient in the fact that it just starts you at the last save and you can make your way back there, and not having, like, knowing the way to get to him and not having to pick up every treasure chest along the way made that pretty painless. So I faced the boss again, got to the third form, and I was like, my heart was pumping. Like, I was just like, oh shit, like it's past midnight. I want to finish this. Please let me finish this. And,
yeah,
you know, the boss towards the end, like, unleashes an attack that wastes all of his magic points. And I'm like, oh shit, but I survived. Yes. But then he does something like the text. I had the text scrolling at the maximum speed and I missed what it said, but it looked like he regained all his MP. Fuck. But then right at the last, you know, last second, I hit him and he disappears. And I'm just so relieved. And that felt great. Like, I, you know, it's been forever, I feel, since I actually finished an RPG. I always give up towards the end because, yeah, like, these games always tend to drag on toward, you know, right at the last minute. I remember playing Final Fantasy X, and up until pretty much, like, the time where you can choose to face the last boss, the game is very, very linear, almost like Final Fantasy XIII. But you do have the option of doing side quests. And I was like, you know, I don't feel like doing side quests. I've been playing this for 40 hours. But then I tried to face the boss and I couldn't even like scratch the outer shell that was protecting it. So I ended up just, you know, YouTubing the ending instead. And yeah, there's so many RPGs like that I didn't finish. So, you know, it felt really good to finally finish an RPG, even though it's not my favorite Dragon Quest. But then I read online that there's post-game content, and I'm like, okay, well, I'm okay with not doing that if it's just an extra for the DS version. No, it was in the original game. And then I read what this content is. It's just one extra dungeon. Okay, it's not too bad. And there's one extra boss. And then there's a new ending. Maybe I can do that. But then, you know, my characters are all towards, you know, almost at level 40. And you have to get to level 70, according to this FAQ.
What?
You have to get to at least level 70 in order to have a chance against the last boss, because not only is he really, really powerful, but also you have, like, a limit of 20 turns against him. Otherwise, you lose.
Guillaume, you have the universe's permission to stop playing this game. You have beaten it.
No, I do not give permission. I expect you to have this beaten by Pax.
I'm very aware that I don't have to do this, and I'm not interested. Like, just, you know, like, it took me 40 hours to beat the game. It sounds like it would take at least 20 more hours to level up enough in this one crummy dungeon to face the last boss. It doesn't sound worth it. But at the same time, it's kind of robbing me of the satisfaction of having completed the game. It really annoys me. Like, I know it's bonus content for the hardcore fans, but it's kind of bringing down my enjoyment of finishing it.
Yeah, like, you can't just put it on the shelf, right?
Why? I will. I can.
Yeah, well, you're forced to.
I mean, that's on you. Some people get obsessive and they feel like they never actually finish games, and they end up just playing the shit out of it. And you can play a game to the point where you start to resent it.
Yeah, so I don't want to do
and
that.
You should not let yourself get to that point.
Yeah.
I mean, I've had the experience of, I play a game, it's just like, God, just go. And then on the off chance, occasionally something happens and I'm back in the game again. And that's the weirdest feeling, because you're ready for the game to just go away. Like, even if you just loved the hell out of the game, and it's just gotten to the point where you're just ready to stop.
Yeah.
And maybe the game does something, some hand-wavy magic that does something really cool, and you're like, oh, I'm back in. I'm in. I'm so in right now. That it's this weird thought process in your head of like, I didn't want to play this anymore, but why don't I keep picking up the controller? Oh, shit, I'm enjoying this again. And the best instance I have of that was The Last Remnant, where at like hour 40, it kicks back in, and I'm like, oh my god, this is cool again. Oh yeah, game. Oh yeah, let's do this.
Well, as Johnny pointed out last week, Dragon Quest games are very similar. So, you know, I could, I guess, keep playing this one, but instead I could get 20 hours into another Dragon Quest game.
Yeah.
That sounds way more interesting.
Yeah.
Those 20 hours will not help you save the world. It won't.
I've already saved the world. I saw the credits.
The world done been saved, James.
There is a badass in the dungeon who needs another 30 levels. I'm pretty sure he's dangerous.
The choice is easy. I'll just, play 20 hours of something else.
Say that to the children who he will eat.
I support you, Guillaume. I got your back on this.
The choice was so easy.
Thank you.
Because you're so delicious.
Oh, man. So I guess I'll probably wrap up new business here with a game that I know a couple of you have already played and a lot of people have been talking about, and some people have been trying to convince me to play it. I got Little Inferno last week. It's on sale. It's not even on sale. I think they permanently reduced the price to $10, which seems like it probably should have always been the price.
Basically. Well, I mean, it's basically a sadism simulator. So yeah, it probably should have been. Burn that school bus!
Little Inferno is hard to describe. And it's even if you tell people what it is and what you do in it, it's very hard to describe why it's appealing and why people like it. And now
and
that
then
I
you lose
it,
your recording and people don't even get to listen to your attempt.
Oh, man, I forgot about
it's
that.
It's more
yeah.
like you describe throwing a school bus into fire and people are like, I don't want to talk to him anymore.
Yeah, it is a very, very strange game. But after playing it now, I get why people like it. I also get why people have a hard time articulating why they like it. Because it does have this weird kind of intangible quality to it that makes it very addictive and weirdly just compelling and interesting. A lot of it has to do with the writing and the art. Even the writing much more than the art, I would say, because the game's story, most of the flavor and the context for what you're doing and maybe why you're doing it is all in the writing. And the game's vibe, you know, I mean, this is from the guys who made World of Goo, and that mm-hmm. game had a very kind of Tim Burton kind of a feel to it. I think mm-hmm. the feel of Little Inferno is actually more Ren and Stimpy. And I don't know how many people playing this game now actually, I don't know that if that's a, like a cultural touchstone anymore, but it is for me. I mean, I grew up on Ren and Stimpy. It's gross. It's weird. It's full of like these bizarre non sequitur jokes, very inappropriate stuff. It was kind of like the proto South Park in some ways, not as political or social commentary, but you know, it was very much sort of pushing the boundaries of what you could get away with in a cartoon. And it, especially on Nickelodeon, it was just disgusting and just had this really kind of vile, bizarre sense of humor. And I feel like Little Inferno is, I was really surprised that it reminded me of that. But once I got that feeling, I started to kind of click into it, and it started to get a lot more interesting for me. And, you know, I'm only like halfway through the game. I haven't played, I mean, it's obviously not a very long game, but I haven't been inclined to sit down and play it for like 4 or 5 hours straight. But I have played it in a couple of like maybe 1 hour sessions. And when you see just how little interaction there is in the game, and this is like the gameplay is like almost on like Facebook game proportions, because it is a lot of mm-hmm. basically clicking on this catalog of items, and then literally you wait for a pie chart to fill up as the timer counts down for these things to show up. I mean, it really yeah. is almost like one of these energy based games where you take certain actions and then you just have to wait for a while before you can take them again. And
it sounds like those mid-90s interactive screensavers.
There is this weird kind of interactive screensaver vibe to it, for sure.
But the game is also overtly making fun of free-to-play games. And
yes.
There's like, you can buy some sort of tablet to burn, of course. But like, I think the description is billions of free games that will cost you millions or something like that.
Yeah, the game is very satirical, and the writing is truly funny. Some of the artwork is very funny too, and the animations of what, because a lot of things when you burn them, it's not just about watching them be destroyed. It's that once you heat them up or light them on fire, certain mechanisms or certain things about them sort of activate. And a lot of the fun is not just seeing things blow up or disintegrate, it's seeing what they do before that happens. Once you light them on fire, you know, some certain like sort of biological items that you put in there will kind of freak out and they'll flip around because they're on fire, you know, and they're trying to put themselves out. A lot of the more mechanical stuff is interesting because once you light it on fire, it starts to kind of like some pressure builds up or some piece of it kind of pops out and starts, you know, actuating or whatever until it finally burns down enough. So there is stuff to watch going on here. It's not just fire. It's not like watching a fireplace with just logs burning away. There's much more going on than that.
But you can do that in WiiWare 7 different ways.
Oh, that's true. Yeah. Yes. And I think the game is very much also a parody of those. You know, it is a parody of actual fireplace simulators as well. So there's a lot of satire going on here. The one thing I want to say, cause I mean, I can't talk about the end game or the, you know, the more advanced catalog items, cause I haven't gotten there yet. But, I do feel like, you know, you can play this entirely on the gamepad. I do not think that is a good way to play it, because you miss out on not just a lot of the artwork, which does look good in HD, and it is one of the only things in the game, and it's one of the reasons to play it. But also, I feel like the text in the catalog, you spend a lot of time looking through these catalogs of items that you want to order so that you can burn in the fireplace. And the writing in the descriptions for these items is really funny, and it's one of the best things in the game. And it's kind of hard to read on the gamepad because the screen is just so small. So I would really recommend, even though it seems natural to kind of use a stylus and draw these flames around and kind of do all the things on the touchscreen, I would recommend you pick up a Wii Remote and do it on the TV so that you can really see and read all of this stuff that's in the game.
I actually played the game mostly on the gamepad. It's true, it's written small, but I didn't have... It's not a case of like certain games that you couldn't read if you were playing on an SD set. Like it's still clear, it's just small.
It's just small. It's just I started to get a little bit of eye strain, and I found that I preferred playing it on the TV for that reason. But it's very interesting. It's certainly not going to be everyone's cup of tea, but it's more fun than I was expecting. And mainly, I'm appreciating the presentation of it. Mostly, you know, especially the writing. And I think $10 is a very fair price to pay for the kind of experience that this is. I mean, it is basically an art game. It's like an experimental game. And I think $10 is a good price for that. $15, you know, especially like in the download space on eShop or WiiWare or, you know, XBLA or whatever, for $15, I expect to get something with some meat on the bones, some good mechanics, some good gameplay for $15. And I don't really think that's here. But but I think the new price is much closer to what you would expect for what you get out of it. But it's very interesting. There's certainly nothing else quite like it, that's for sure.
And that might actually be a good thing.
Yes, it is a good thing, for sure. All right, guys. Well, we're going to have to end new business. I think we've gone for a little over an hour now. And thanks, by the way, James, for kicking the show off when I wasn't here yet.
This is my dominion now!
We're going to take a break now. And when we come back, we got your listener mail. Stick around.
Here's a quick look at the best original content at our website, now playing at NintendoWorldReport.com.
First up this week, we have a review for Runner 2, Future Legend of Rhythm Alien by Neil. I'm Charles Martinet, and this is the rhythm platforming alien returning in Runner 2. Neil heaps otherworldly praise on the sequel of the Bit Trip classic, while mostly avoiding run puns.
Not totally.
And we have a video for the first 10 minutes of Retro City Rampage by Rory Cocker. Grand Theft 8-Bit is finally out, on Wii no less. Well, you can play it on your Wii U. Enjoy.
Alright, and we also have a review by our own Guillaume Bayet. A review of Fist of the North Star 2 Ken's Rage for Wii U. Get punched in the head and explode. Fist of the North Star is all about it. And Guy thinks it's great. And if you doubt me, you're already dead.
I think I'm getting trolled in the Miiverse because there's tons of people just saying, like, oh, you don't like a good story.
That's awesome. You just don't appreciate a good story. You're just not cultured, Guillaume. All right. And then we also have an edition of Extra Life, which is, I don't know, all about Castlevania the Adventure. Nate took a ride around as the slow-moving Game Boy Vampire Hunter with no meaningful skills. Game design in the 90s was so much better.
We have a review. I believe this is Curtis Bones, a new writer for the site.
He is
his
new.
First
yes.
review. Air Battle Hockey 3D on the 3DS. Super Glove Ball 3D. Air Battle Hockey 3D is all about it. Guess how that works out. Yeah, it's pretty ho-hum. Oh well, at least it isn't Gyromite.
Why would it be?
Well, because
know.
If we're going to make it about a game related to one stupid NES peripheral, at least it's the Power Glove and not fucking Rob.
It's pretty inside James Ball right there.
Does the hockey game have a peripheral?
No, but it's basically Super Glove Ball. It is some Super Glove Ball on the 3DS.
That is really obscure, James.
It is. It's, well, if you look at I saw the screenshot, that's fucking Super Glove Ball. What the hell?
Okay.
Anyway, lastly this week, Nintendo World Report Powered Off Volume 3 is out right now. Johnny explores the question of Pikmin as a strategy game, and I say nice things about Sega and bad things about mini-golf.
You also say some bad things about Sega. So if you haven't seen Powered Off yet, it's really, really good. It's basically the magazine version of our website with some exclusive content, as James described there. So it's free, of course. It's a PDF. It's really cool. You can read it on your tablet or right on your computer desktop or even print it out and read it on the toilet. Whatever you want to do is fine by us. You can find Powered Off and all of this other great original content right over there at NintendoWorldReport.com. Welcome back, everyone. I'm hosting this time.
No!
Sorry. It is time for listener mail, and we have a lot to catch up on. We haven't done this in a few weeks. So, as always, the address for your emails is rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. And Guillaume is going to read the first letter this week.
Nice. So, Torbjorn writes, there seemed to be some disagreement on whether Pikmin was actually a strategy game. Maybe I've been tainted by Nintendo propaganda as well, but I wanted to add some points to the discussion. First off, I do agree that the main story mode is more of an adventure game, but you did not discuss the challenge mode, where you have to collect as many Pikmin as possible during the course of one in-game day. I would argue that this mode is highly strategic. You have to figure out how many Pikmin you need to efficiently cover the different areas, map out different routes, micromanage your Pikmin so that they pick up pellets of the same color as themselves, and so on. You also mentioned that there was no real multitasking, but if you don't have Pikmin working in different areas of the map at the same time, you will do poorly. And although you have to physically move Olimar across the map, that just means that you have to put the time you spend moving into the equation. I've played this mode quite a bit, and my scores have improved drastically. So to me at least, that implies that there is some element of strategy or skill to this.
Yeah, that's a really good argument.
I never said that there is no skill in Pikmin, to be fair.
Yeah, I don't think anyone said that. I think you guys said that if it's a strategy game, there's just not a whole lot of strategy to it.
And I think that regardless of skill, just because it involves skill doesn't mean it involves a lot of strategy.
Yeah, agreed. They're two. Yeah, mm-hmm. those are two separate things. But I'm not that familiar with the challenge mode. It's not something that I would probably spend much time in. But to me, this speaks to part of the reason I prefer Pikmin 1 versus Pikmin 2, and it's part of the reason I feel like Pikmin 1 is more strategic than Pikmin 2, because in the first game, you do have to manage time so much. So it forces you to do things like multitasking and trying to find the best path and trying to find the most efficient way to do things, because you're under this very, very challenging time crunch. And most people, myself included, the first time through Pikmin, don't finish the game before the 30 days are up and you have to start over from scratch. And to me, the greatest testament to that game's entertainment value and just the way it's made so well is that when it happened to me, I was thrilled to start over. I was so excited at how much better I would do and how much more I understood how to play the game at that point. I had no problem. I immediately started over. But Pikmin 2, you don't have to do that. There's no chance that you'll ever have to start the game over because there's no time limit. And because of that, as I was playing it, I felt like, you know, this is definitely less stressful, but I also felt that I was playing it in a lazier way because I could. You know, I could take the convenient way out. I would end days early quite often just to save myself the trouble of having to walk over somewhere and get halfway there before daylight fell, you know? So just out of sheer convenience, I wouldn't even try to push myself to try to go do that one extra thing before the day ended because I knew I didn't need to. And so I might as well just burn the rest of the day and just do it in the morning. And I many times I've said Pikmin 2 is a great game. I gave it a very strong review on the website. And I understand why some people prefer it, but for me, that's one of the main reasons. I feel like it demands less of you in strategic terms than the first game does.
Yeah, I can see where that's going. I mean, I never really got through the challenge modes. I'm just thinking of myself playing the single player game and understanding that to me it just still feels very actiony. And this is a fantastic plug by Johnny for the article he wrote for Powered Off. Well done.
We got this letter before that was published, so I don't think Torbjorn knew that I was even doing that when he wrote this letter, but
unless you're Torbjorn.
Exposed.
Well, admittedly, I have more experience with 2. I actually own it, whereas the first one I only rented. And I did not have that experience of having to start over. Like, I got my GameCube well after the launch, and so when I rented Pikmin, I was duly warned that, you had to be fast, and I might have actually started over a day or two here and there just to make sure that I, you know, got a piece of the ship per day at least. So yeah, I did not have to start the whole game over. I can see how the experience would be different. Like I've never played the challenge mode, and I don't know if that makes me unfit to talk about whether it's a strategy game or not.
Yeah, well, I mean, if that's the case, it makes me unfit as well. But I do think, you know, in the context of Pikmin 3 coming out supposedly in a few months, we still don't have a release date or anything. But, you know, supposedly before, I guess, the midpoint in the year, it's supposed to come out. And we've heard that it might be more like Pikmin 1, but we're not really sure what that means or to what extent that might be the case. Maybe it's optional. who knows? But I think it's going to inform a lot of our expectations for that game once we figure it out. And, you know, I do think that see, that was the kind of crazy thing to me in Pikmin 2, where they gave you this other character, Louie, and now you can actually, you know, have two captains and controlling two very different groups of Pikmin on two completely different sides of the map and really doing some pretty advanced, sophisticated multitasking. And the crazy thing to me is in Pikmin 2, you don't actually need that because there's no time crunch. So they give you this massive capability that you didn't have in the first game, and they don't really ask you to use it in an interesting way. And if they could take that element, we've already seen there are up to four different, player characters in Pikmin 3. Maybe they're controlled by different people. Maybe you can play as all of them in single player and just kind of rotate around. But if they're going to give you that many opportunities to split your forces and to set up these more complex cooperative situations with different groups of Pikmin, then I think going back to having some kind of time challenge where you do have to be more efficient is just a much better motivator to actually take advantage of that feature. So I'm hoping that's the way it's going to go. But yeah, as James said, you can read more about this stuff in Powered Off. And I went back and dug up some quotes from old reviews and E3 impressions and even from Miyamoto interviews. And it's not very clear at all from back in 2001 what we thought of it. And I think part of it is just, you know, in my mind over time, and I think with Billy's too, as we heard, this issue had sort of been settled over time because maybe just people weren't talking about it anymore. But if you go back to when the game was first shown, it was actually a source of some controversy and certainly quite a bit of discussion as to whether this really was a strategy game or not. So it's very interesting, to go back and look at that stuff. So I hope you'll check that out.
I guess like you really have to, like we would really need to hone in on what is a strategy game, because some of the arguments that we made about, like, oh, there's not really much multitasking and things like that. I was reading, not this email, but, like, some of the argument on the forums. And as I was reading someone's argument that there's a lot of multitasking in Pikmin, I was thinking, wow, that sounds like he's describing Order Up. Is Order Up a strategy game? And I was just like,
Order Up that is the ultimate strategy game.
It just confused me, you know, like, okay, so what is a strategy game? And I don't know. I guess that the debate could go on for a long time.
Well, I mean, I guess you would boil it down to that being a core component of the game design, like trying to develop a strategy to defeat an opponent rather than just coming up on the fly.
But even then, you know, I have some of my most inspired moments in strategy games where I'm thinking, oh shit, what do I do now?
Yeah.
And to a certain extent, coming up with the fly is a talent that lends itself well to strategy games, quick thinking, problem solving. I think the difference, and where this becomes somewhat difficult to manage, is it sort of goes where Guillaume was saying, juggling is a part of strategy games. You have to be able to manage multiple things at one time.
Oh, and like in StarCraft, it's huge.
In almost any strategy game, it's huge. You have to know if you're going to try to execute multiple approaches at one time, you have to manage all of those things. You can't.
Yeah.
You can't become singularly minded on one thrust if you're trying to get around the other side, because you're just going to screw it up.
Yeah.
It goes back to what we were talking about with Skulls of the Shogun, where you're having to kind of manage these number of turns you have and still achieve your objective without totally presenting yourself bare to be annihilated.
Yeah.
But it's more than just juggling. It's juggling with the goal of accomplishing something that may not be immediately apparent. It may be something you can't just directly do. It's juggling to the ends of accomplishing a thing that requires some level of problem solving. And to me, that's where I struggle with Pikmin as a strategy game, because most feats are just a matter of collecting the correct Pikmin and lobbing them.
Well, I mean, would you say it's more actually tactics than it is actually devising an overall strategy?
But what combat tactics do you have to choose from? I mean, I lob red, I lob green, I lob blue.
Yeah, I mean, not as many. There is some stuff in terms of the timing and, like, maybe in some cases the angle that you approach the enemy from, because they're vulnerable on one side, not the other.
Right.
But, I mean, a lot of that stuff applies to action games as well.
Yeah, and that's why it's easier for me to categorize it as an action game with maybe some strategy juggling elements.
Yeah. Like, it's not Risk.
Well, I mean, right. James, one area I can agree with you on is that one thing I always found lacking in Pikmin is, especially in the combat, I feel like the combat is a little bit too simplistic. It's too easy to win by just having
volume of fire,
by having the numbers, yeah. or just by using, you know, basically in a lot of confrontations, there is one kind of Pikmin that will solve this very easily. And if you use any other kind, it's going to be almost impossible. And I felt like a lot of those conflicts that they throw you into are a little overly simplistic. And I was always kind of hoping for something that required a little bit more management of, well, I'm going to use this kind of Pikmin to do this part while this other one comes around and hits him from the back or something like that. And part of the problem in the previous games is that actually filtering through the Pikmin, especially on yes. the fly when you're really under a time crunch, the controls just aren't really built for that. And one thing that I'm really hoping to see in Pikmin 3 is that they give you better tools for choosing to fling only one kind of Pikmin, or even for creating like small groups and like kind of keying in on certain formations that might even have multiple different kinds of Pikmin in them, but you can control them separately, which yeah. is something you can do very easily in like a PC real-time strategy game. You can create like subgroups of units that you can just hit a number on the keyboard and it'll highlight all of them. And that can be any mixture of different kinds of units. And that might be like your task force that's assigned to some very specific objective while you have other people go and do this other stuff. And Pikmin just up to now, at least so far, hasn't really given you that level of control. And I think if they want to give us more challenging strategic kinds of situations that we have to get through in Pikmin 3, they need to give us the tools to enable that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, where it fell down was that I really can't give an order and know it's going to be carried out, because it's not. I can very singularly put you on the battlefield and just throw you into the fight, but I can't from one position say, hey, go up there and meet me around. I can't develop an approach for countering or enveloping. I have to be there to direct the action. It's kind of a it makes it hard to have juggling as a mechanic, because you're more or less singularly focused on what's going on around and in front of Olimar.
Mm-hmm.
So the entire rest of the map is entirely irrelevant to you for the majority of the mission.
Very valid. Very valid. It's why this is a gray space, and it's kind of fun to talk about. But I have a feeling some of our listeners are probably ready for us to leave this question in the past and move on to other things. So,
is Kirby's Epic Yarn a strategy game? Go.
So I have the next email. Steve writes, not enough was said, in my opinion, about Nintendo's role or share of the blame with the whole Rayman Legends fiasco. If they want third-party support and to move consoles, it is on them, Nintendo, to sign exclusive deals with these companies. One day, Nintendo may have to spend money to make money like every single other business in the free world. Meanwhile, they are becoming irrelevant to the average non-Nintendo-biased gamer, and for good reason. No casual player wants this thing, so they have no audience aside from the faithful core such as us. They are a first-party-only device, and that's the end of that. With Devil May Cry, Metal Gear Rising, Bioshock Infinite, Dead Space 3, Anarchy Reigns, Grand Theft Auto 5, Far Cry 3, and Crysis 3 all not coming to the Wii U, I find any other position impossible to defend. Discuss.
Well, I mean, that's the thing. I mean, it's a valid point. I mean, other companies do go out of their way to sign deals, right? And you can call that money hats, but it doesn't really matter, because really all we care about as gamers are the results.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I don't care who they pay.
I think the concept of money hats is overblown in the industry. I think it is done on a pretty rare occasion. And it certainly does happen. Like the thing that that you mentioned in New Business, John, about Call of Duty and that the map packs always come first to the Xbox. Mm-hmm. Activision is literally being paid by Microsoft to do that, because Microsoft will make so much money on the DLC sales for that it's worth it to them. And they did the same thing with GTA 4 with the expansion downloads for that game. And so I would say Microsoft has been the most proactive about this, probably, and it could very well be because they got into this whole industry much later than the other companies. So even back on the first Xbox, they were trying to play catch up and develop these third party relations from zero, basically. And I think they probably got into that mindset of, we really need to shell out some money to actually make these deals and get this to happen. But I think, you know, I think it, even back then it was kind of limited, and a lot of games that were exclusive back then were exclusive maybe because the developer doesn't know how to develop for the other platform. Maybe the publisher just doesn't think it's worth it. Maybe they have kind of a more of a handshake agreement. Like supposedly with the Capcom 5. Now, of course, we all know how that deal turned out. But when that was first announced, Nintendo swore up and down that they were not paying Capcom to get all these exclusives on the GameCube. It's just they were making an agreement. Basically, Nintendo was going to help promote these games. They were going to help support the development, you know, give Capcom all the resources and support that they needed. And Capcom wanted to do it because they felt GameCube was going to be the leader in Japan. And they really wanted to commit to it and not have to worry about developing other versions of their game. And that all fell apart, you know, and it, maybe you could argue that without throwing money into it, the deal is just not going to hold up. You know, ultimately going multi-platform is just too lucrative. I don't know. Mm-hmm.
But even throwing money into it, the deal may not hold up. I mean, they could have given Ubisoft money for Rayman, or maybe Ubisoft said, all right, here's your money back. I mean, they could have said, here's your money back for making an exclusive. We think we can make more money by putting it on all the platforms. So then, I mean, regardless of what kind of contract you write, there's always going to be an out.
Yeah.
So, yes, you can give money to these companies to make versions of their games for your system, but that ultimately is a losing proposition in the long run, because you make money by them publishing the game on your system and paying you for the privilege.
Yeah.
Granted, there's the argument of, well, you won't get the install base without the games, but if you're already paying money to get the games, what good is the install base? Because you've already lost.
The one thing that you have to understand in this is that Nintendo, they can make a ton of money just by making their own games.
Yes.
And that's been the whole thing. That's been the whole reason why there's always been this tension between Nintendo and third parties, as often third parties are competing against Nintendo for the lion's share of the money made on their consoles. Now, that's not saying that third parties have always put their best foot forward in terms of producing the best games for Nintendo consoles, but Nintendo typically makes games that sell the most on their consoles. So,
because their fans want what they want. I mean,
well, yeah, exactly. Yep.
Yeah, but that also leads to the problem. I think the real reason that all these other games, I mean, all the games that Steve mentioned here in his list, Devil May Cry and Metal Gear Rising and, you know, Dead Space 3, none of these are exclusive to either Sony or Microsoft or even to PC. Mm-hmm. These are all multi-platform games. They're just not coming to this platform. And to me, in cases like Crysis 3, you know, or something like that, you can maybe argue that it has to do with technical capability, or the developer just kind of famously just doesn't care about Nintendo, and they don't want to work within the RAM constrictions or whatever. Mm-hmm. We've heard stuff like that before. That's why we never got Max Payne on GameCube, because the developer said, the GameCube doesn't have enough RAM. Of course, they made a version for PS2 that had half as much RAM as GameCube did.
Yeah.
So who knows what, you know, what was really going on there. But I think the main issue here is that, you know, Nintendo doesn't necessarily need to pay companies to put games on their system, not even for exclusives. I think they could actually get some parity release with a lot of these games if the publishers felt like there was enough demand, like if they felt there were enough Wii U's out there to make it worth their time. And, you know, some of these games are a little more niche, like Anarchy Reigns. I'm not really sure that, you know, that game did well on any system.
Well, yeah, it's not even that good of a game, so
GTA 5, actually, I could believe that could even still now be announced for Wii U at E3 or something like that. I mean, because that game's not actually coming out until September, which gives them some time.
And that game is going to cost so much to develop. Why would they not have it on every single platform?
And also, that is the series that Reggie covets more than all others.
He does.
He's been very open about it over the years. He really wants GTA to be on Nintendo systems. They tried it with DS, made a fantastic game with Chinatown Wars, sold like shit, which is a real shame.
And that's your fault, listeners.
It's a real shame. That game is awesome.
It's debatable if it would have sold to fans of GTA 3 because, like, we were back to the view from above, the action, you know, and...
Oh, it's a weird game. I mean, it's not an easy sell despite the name.
No, but it's so good.
But it's really fantastic. But, I mean, the main reason that third parties don't want to release their stuff on Wii U right now, I don't think it has to do it with fearing competition from Nintendo. I don't think it has to do with lack of money hats. I think it has to do with lack of Wii U's in people's houses.
Yeah, Wii U is an entirely different case in the past, for sure.
Yeah, and the blame for that is not on the way Nintendo has dealt with third parties. I'm sure there are some flaws in their strategy with, you know, courting publishers, giving them early development kits, things like that. I know there have been some problems with that. But the main issue is Nintendo's first-party games aren't selling enough. Mm-hmm. They're not selling enough copies. They're not selling enough systems. If Mario was as big as Wii Sports, all these games would be on Wii U. Because I think it is technically capable of running probably all of these games.
I don't know if that's really the answer, though. Because, like, the publishers, when they made the decision of not porting these games, like, day and date, a Wii U version with the other ones, like, they couldn't have known that Mario wouldn't take off like the Wii did. Like, I mean, they probably had some idea, like, from analysts and things like
from
that.
From E3,
but...
I think they knew. I think they looked at Nintendo Land and said,
I think there's also just the fact that all of us have like a PS3 or an Xbox or a PC, and if we can't buy Metal Gear Rising on the Wii U and we really want to play it, well, we'll just buy another version.
Yeah.
Like, they don't have a reason really to go through the trouble of making a port, because we're going to end up buying these games anyway, somewhere else, at less cost to the publishers.
Exactly. Well, you have to remember, too, that these companies, they already have teams of, you know, PS3 devs, Xbox devs, you know, teams that know how to do this. They have all the hardware they need. They have all the test kits they need. They have all that stuff in-house already. So it's very easy for them to just spin off of one, you know, 360 project and just spin up a new 360 project. Whereas with Wii U, they would have to buy all the hardware, figure out how to use it, figure out how to set it up, get some test kits, get familiar with it. That can take months, right? So that's just, and like what Johnny said, without having the sales to justify that, they're not going to dive into that for the heck of it.
And I think games like Metal Gear Rising, there's good reason. That game was in development for about a million years.
Yeah, exactly.
It's like 7 hours long.
It basically got made twice.
That game had serious ass problems. And I really doubt Konami was like, all right, guys, I know it's been tough. But let's go ahead and make a Wii U version too on top of it. It'll be fine. Konami's like, guys, just fucking finish the game. God.
I could actually see that one getting some kind of like special edition
later on
for Wii U because Platinum made it and Konami has a pretty good relationship with Wii U. And I could see maybe that one is not out of the question just yet, but it'll be a while. But I mean, John, I think your point is actually really important and I hadn't thought about this, but the fact that these other systems that the games are getting released on as multi-platform launches are already so well established that, for one thing, it's easier to release it on multiple because you got teams that actually understand 360 and PS3 really well.
And understand how to port between the two.
Yep,
but also, if you think about it, in the early days of, you know, let's assume all this never really happens, but let's assume all the systems come out at the same time. So you have a real generation. You know, there's an end of the previous generation and a very clean cut transition to the new one. You can assume, I think, as a publisher in the new generation, that most gamers will only own one of those systems because they're the most expensive that they'll ever be in terms of hardware. And they haven't been around long enough for people to find deals or to be convinced to pick up the other ones. So if you think about it, like back in 2006, let's say, at the end of 2006, very few people owned an Xbox 360 and a PS3. Mm-hmm. So if you're releasing a multi-platform game, if you're releasing a third-party game, period, you'd like it to be on both, because that way you can actually hit two different markets. But at this point, those systems have been out for so long that a lot of people actually already have both. And more importantly, with the Wii U situation, you've got a system that is similar power level to the systems that are already out there. But just like you said, I think these publishers can very safely assume that a lot of people who own Wii U's also have a 360 or a PS3.
Yeah.
So they don't need to cater specifically to that audience like they would if all the systems had been released at the same time.
But now, since this email was written, like, we've learned that both Destiny, the Bungie shooter, and Watch Dogs, Ubisoft's next generation game, are both coming to Wii U.
Destiny is? That's confirmed?
Isn't it?
I don't know that it was hard confirmed, but there is enough evidence at this point to say, yeah, it probably is.
Yeah, like, I thought that retailers had... Well, that doesn't really mean anything.
Retailers had it, and their website had references to Wii U versions on it.
Anyway, so at the same time, like, these games are being made also, like, with PS3 and Xbox 360 versions in mind. But still, like, the Wii U is included in this. And I don't remember where I've read this, but I believe that Yves Guillemot... I believe that he said that, you know, they're developing Watch Dogs for PS4 and Wii U, actually, and whatever the Xbox
that goes back to what we talked about last week, where there will be lots of games that are in both generations. Right.
But they're developing for those systems, or so they claim, and then they're going to downport to PS3 and Xbox.
Well, so, but, I mean, with those two, it's like, I mean, the two companies that always make Nintendo console games right at the very start are Ubisoft and Activision. So I think they're kind of the exception to the rule.
Sure, but at the same time, it's reassuring to hear that, you know, the Wii U is kind of hanging up there with the PS4. I mean, we've learned now that it doesn't really, they're not going to hang at the same level in terms of, you know, power, in terms of hardware, but apparently the Wii U is closer to the PS4 than it is to the PS3. That's reassuring.
Oh, certainly, yeah.
Yeah, right. I would say that's the case, yeah, for sure.
Yeah, it's not a downport, essentially, is what Guillaume is saying. It's a side version of the other two next gen systems.
Well, right. Wii U is a PowerPC derivative, so it's not x86 in the way that PS4 is, so it's not as PC like as PS4.
Right.
But it makes it a lot closer to the Xbox architecture.
Which
people are very familiar with because of the success of Xbox 360.
This is the most reactionary Sony has ever been with the hardware design following the Cell.
Yeah, really. Yeah.
They needed to be, though. I mean, the Cell was a disaster.
It really was.
The system really, I mean, PS3, when you hear people slag on it, like, especially like in the mainstream media, you hear these reports about PS4 and they talk about how it is a reaction to PS3. They always say PS3 was a disappointment. And that's because, I mean, they sold over 75 million consoles. They'll probably end up over 80 or 85 million when all is said and done. It's hardly a failure. Hardly.
No, not even close. The thing is,
PS2 sold like 120 million. So no doubt it is a huge disappointment for Sony because they expected to do even better with PS3 than they did PS2. And that was not to be.
I mean, effectively, they got kicked down to third place in the biggest market in the world.
Yeah.
Yeah. Even though they're kind of tied with 360
worldwide.
But in
the North American market, they went from commanding and demandingly first all the way to
they
third.
Lost a lot of prestige. And they lost a lot of money.
Well, that's the thing. And of course, they made the brilliant move of putting out one of the most costly consoles ever into one of the worst economies ever.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, they did that. And then they made the guy responsible for it CEO of the company.
Yeah. It's pretty amazing. But even despite all of that, yeah, the PS3 is in no way a failure. At all,
there are failures in the PS3's long-term vision. There are individualized failures. It failed to maintain the position that Sony had placed it in, which is the vanguard of the Sony ecosystem in your home.
So James has got the next letter.
Nathan in Toronto writes, quote, "I think we can finally put to bed the notion of the Wii U being a next-gen console." Unquote. Colin Moriarty, Beyond 28 number 281.
Is that a podcast?
It's an IGN podcast.
Okay. Oh.
Podcast Beyond. Yeah. Okay. Yeah, yeah.
Anyway, I have heard similar statements made from different media outlets over the past few months. Perhaps you have as well. What is troubling to me is that there appears to be a narrative discourse being created for the Wii U before the system has a chance to prove itself. The discourse appears to be concocted primarily amongst gaming journalists. Last generation buzzwords were casual versus hardcore, a pair of ill-defined terms that would lay the groundwork for the juvenile battlefield primarily consisting of playground taunting and message board fury. The problem I see is not that fanboys are renewing the seemingly ageless need to debate of the inane, but the way that the press frames the message. Calling the Wii a, quote, casual system fit for grandparents and toddlers soon found its way into the collective lexicon, and I feel it unfairly generalized the system as something it is not. The new message for 2012 is that the Wii U is not truly part of the 8th generation, clearly a concerted effort to minimalize the relevance of the system. What do these attempts to disenfranchise Nintendo products, and by extension their fan base, say about the integrity of the current gaming press? Are they problematic in other ways? Well,
are we going to talk about the integrity of the gaming press, really?
John, as our worst ombudsman slash site director ever.
We're going to be here a while.
Go ahead and give us a birds and beans breakdown of integrity.
At this point, I think the gaming press are probably just thankful to have jobs if they still have
them. If they do still have them. Hmm. I mean, the thing about the gaming press, as the term is concerned, and to be fair, we're all members of it here.
Sort of. I mean, we're not professionally, though. I mean, I think we do have a very different take on it than...
Yeah. You know, we are actually fanboys, not paid fanboys.
But I mean, we are enough that we have. I mean, we know some of these people. We've met some of these people.
Oh yeah,
we've
talked with friends with them.
Yeah, we've punched some of these people.
Maybe, but I haven't been to Los Angeles since then, so I'm fine. But I mean, we can't take a purely objective look at this because for two reasons. One, because we are fans of the systems that. In this letter says we're being marginalized, but also because we are members of the press to enough of an extent that we have, you know, experienced writing statements like this that may come off as incendiary or adversarial or have been in the position to respond to those kinds of statements. It's a difficult thing for us to approach. Be that as it may, it's very... I'm not going to say it's troubling. I'm going to say it's a bit juvenile to kind of push agendas like this when you're writing. But at the same time, people want their writers to write opinion. Just getting the facts is great for Twitter. You can just read what's going on there. But to really get people to care about what you're writing, you almost have to put a certain amount of opinion in there. Just getting the news is relevant for a day at the most. But if you're putting forward a forward-viewing opinion of something, it's much easier to make that as an evergreen link on your site. And ultimately, it's not the goal, but part of what you have to do is get people to read your content. Otherwise, what's the point?
There's no conspiracy here among the gaming media to marginalize Nintendo. I think it is a misconception. It's also a semantic argument, which we're not going to dive into very much, but I've mentioned it before. The idea of next generation is just a BS term. It doesn't actually mean anything. And dwelling on whether this system or that system actually, I mean, people still argue over what generation Dreamcast was in. Who gives a shit? Dreamcast was killed off in less than 2 years. That's the generation it's in. It's in the dead generation. It's in the generation of failure, okay? And that's the concern I have, is not that people will think that Nintendo is behind the times or that they're stuck in the late 2000s or that they're not up to speed with the current consoles, they're not in the same generation. I just want Wii U to be successful so that we get lots of great games for it, you know? And I think the idea, I mean, it can be, you know, just like our argument about Pikmin and being a strategy game or not. I mean, genres are just as semantic and vacuous as the next generation term. There's a range in which these discussions can be fun and entertaining and thought provoking. Mm-hmm. This is one talking about whether a system is in one generation or the not. I find completely pointless. I just don't think there's anything to be gained from pondering this and trying to parse it out because it's almost impossible to even state your claim on whether, you know, you think that it is or it isn't without being incredibly biased for or against the system.
Yeah. Well, I mean, is my PC a next-gen PC? I don't know. What is a next-gen PC? Wait, there are no PC generations.
Case in point. Thank you. The whole idea of this being the eighth console generation is just inane to the point that I can't even address it. I can't stand that stuff.
I hate using the number system as well because it's not even accurate. I mean, what the fuck do you do with, like, the Fairchild Channel F?
It's like when people call Skyward Sword Zelda 9. I just hate that.
I'm
going to
call,
just stop counting.
Mario Kart on 3DS Mario Kart 7.
Well, the thing is, it used to be easy to say, oh, this is next gen, because there was such a hardware jump. But now there's really not that much of a hardware jump anymore, so...
Yeah, like we went from 2D to 3D to 3D that we could actually look at.
3D with textures.
Yeah. To HD. And you know, but now we don't really have that kind of reference point.
Yeah, it's like if the game is released on both the PS3 and the PS4, is it a next-gen game?
Are you a next-gen game, John?
Think about it.
In that case, I mean, this overlap...
This isn't a Zen moment!
This overlapping and the blending of what platforms these come out, even when they come out on sequential platforms that are in the same line, like PS3
or on Steam.
And PS4, I think that's a good thing, because I think it kind of puts this whole thing to bed. You know, it makes it so confusing to even talk about these generations that I hope people will just give up and just say, you know what, it's not about generations. But ultimately, that's not the important thing here. I mean, I think the important thing is that the reason that we got labeled as a casual system has nothing to do with some kind of conspiracy among the gaming press. It has everything to do with Nintendo. That's the way they position that system. They tried very hard to create that image. And once they had that image, they embraced it to the maximum effect. And by the way, it made them a couple $1 billion. So I don't really think they regret it either. I think we, as the hardcore fans, the people who really wanted more out of the Wii, or at least wanted people to pay attention to the stuff that the really great stuff that was happening, I think we resented that. I don't think Nintendo resents their image at all with the
Wii. No, I also think that I think they're perfectly fine being the go-to console for any family that wants to buy something for their kids.
Seriously, because like families won't go get a PS3 most of the time because there's nothing there. Like Sony completely dropped the ball. They really had something for everyone with a PS2 and with a PS3. Like, they actually came out and said, oh, like, we saw what Microsoft was doing with our shooters, and we wanted to be more of that than, like, we wanted to beat them at their own game. Mm-hmm. And so Naughty Dog was kind of moved resources away from making, I don't know, Jack and Daxter sequels and came up with Uncharted and made it more and more into a cover-based shooter.
And God bless them. But to John's point, this is really important. Nintendo would love to be that family console with Wii U. So far, they're failing. That's one of their biggest problems, is they have not gotten that message across, and they have not gained that cultural cachet where everybody knows that if you have kids and you want to be able to play a console with your family, you go to the Wii U. Their problem is that in between the sort of death spiral of Wii and the launch of Wii U, Microsoft came in there with a very ill-advised product, I would argue, the Kinect, and managed to market the shit out of it.
Yep.
And Xbox is now the family console because they've co-opted the whole Nintendo image into Xbox because of Kinect. And now if you have a bunch of kids and you want to sit around and play a video game console in front of the TV, Microsoft has made Xbox the place to do it. And it's largely because of Kinect. And they're in the prominent position right now. And I think it's up to Nintendo to reclaim that. I don't know how they're going to do it.
But so here's the thing. And this is something that I actually, if you watched the Sony press conference to this point, you would have picked up on it a couple times. Sony kept doing a line that Nintendo did during the GameCube. And they basically kept saying, it's all about games.
Yeah, yeah.
And what Microsoft did with the Xbox, they essentially launched that system 4 times. The third
It's kind of amazing, really.
The third launch of that system turned it from a gaming console into a multimedia hub.
Yeah.
The fourth launch turned it into a family console while remaining a multimedia hub.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Getting back to journalists, I mean, you know, there might be a disinterest amongst the gaming press, the enthusiast press about Nintendo, but I do think that when Nintendo does a good thing, like shows something good, that they get rewarded for it, that they get coverage for it. Like, just, like, if you remember, I think it was 2 years ago, they showed off Epic Yarn, and some outlets gave Epic Yarn, like, best graphics of E3. And of course, a lot of, you know, fanboys complained about that, but the fact is that Epic Yarn looked really, really good, but also like really stood out from the rest. Mm-hmm. Like the other nominees were stuff like Bulletstorm, where you kick people in the crotch and impale them or whatever.
Hey. The exploding barrels were green, thank you.
but yeah, and you know, like the last E3, it was really like, you know, the same thing kind of happened with the other conferences. Like, they only showed super violent stuff. Yeah. And Nintendo could have, you know, taken E3 just by showing something really interesting and that really stands out. But what they did was, like, show stuff that we already knew was coming, that we've already seen before, like, only sequels, really, and Nintendo Land, which is basically another Wii Sport in a way. And, like, it's really them who dropped the ball. Instead of, like, the discourse being Nintendo won E3 by standing out and being the only ones not hitting on this, like, super gory, super, you know, tons of sex, mm-hmm. Side of E3.
Bullet sex!
You know, the discourse was just like, wow, like, the conferences were really, really violent, and, you know, E3 was pretty much like the same thing everywhere.
Yeah, Nintendo didn't have anything really substantial and interesting to fill that vacuum. But yeah. I think in terms of E3, it's a good context, because I think it actually proves that there is no conspiracy. It proves that the gaming press is ready and willing to accept and promote Nintendo when they are interested in what Nintendo does. If you go back and look at 2006, when the Wii was first playable at E3. It was the biggest thing that ever happened at E3. It was a fucking circus even trying to get in there to play it. Everybody, and I mean everybody, was talking about it. Everybody was excited about it. Even though, I mean, they had lots of different demos. It wasn't clear how many of these were real games or what they were going to turn out to be. People were just excited for the potential of motion control and what Nintendo was doing. And it was a really exciting time. And I think the reason that they got jaded, or that maybe a lot of people in the gaming press lost interest in Nintendo, is because over time it just bore out that the games they wanted to play weren't on Nintendo, or the games Nintendo made for Wii weren't what people wanted to play. I think if you go back and look at the response to Wii U, the first time that they showed it, it was very, very, very positive. Everybody was super excited and talking about how they were worried. People were worried that it was going to cost $500 because of that awesome controller.
Yep.
You know, they just didn't understand how they were even going to make it affordable.
And how would it even work? I mean,
you fast forward, it took 1 year for that system to start to look dated. That's how fast things change now. And Nintendo, there's nothing they could do about it. They can't go back and re-architect the entire thing and try to change the whole direction, which is good. They should stick with it. They should make it work. But I think mm-hmm. the biggest problem is Nintendo had a whole year after showing those playable Wii U demos, and they came back, and the stuff that they showed us last year at E3, it wasn't really very much different. And it didn't really show a whole lot of innovation or really cool new gameplay ideas that we hadn't already seen the very first time they showed us all those tech demos. And I think that's the biggest problem, is that people are interested in the technology. They're interested in the kinds of things Nintendo is capable of doing, but the company doesn't always deliver. And I think that's when people get really jaded. And if you don't deliver early on, you're not going to capture those people, and you're not going to keep the Nintendo system at the forefront of their minds. They're not always going to be thinking, well, what's this going to play like on Wii U? Or why isn't this on Wii U? Because it's just kind of an also-ran. I mean, you really have to make a very strong statement right up front, and that's been Nintendo's biggest problem with Wii U. I think they can recover from it, but it's going to be difficult.
So can I make one point before we move on about
sure.
this?
But we so should move
I,
on
after I think, that. And it's going to take me a couple steps to get to where I'm going. I think Nintendo does sometimes catch, for the same reasons Johnny's talking about, a little bit of a harder hit than its two competitors. It does. But I think they also have a peak they can get to that's so much more, so much higher than any either of them, because I would imagine most members of the gaming press have some level of emotional attachment with the brand.
Yeah.
I mean, so if you were at E3 2010, what you would have seen was slobbering by some of the most veteran members of the gaming press at Nintendo's lineup at the press conference, where they just rattled off franchises they were going to have games for. Or 2009, excuse me. And then in 2010, if you were at their 3DS section, it was fucking pandemonium. There was nothing to play up there. That was some of the worst demos I've ever experienced at E3. But it
mostly
didn't...
just watching videos in 3D.
People were losing their mind.
Yeah, yeah.
I mean, people were lining up for hours just to get up to this upper tier of their booth to see videos on a 3D screen. I mean, Nintendo, when they do stuff, people in the media, I think, can sometimes swing hard the other way, where maybe they should be a little bit more conservative about it. Right. Nintendo got huge amounts of play out of that Nintendo Direct, where they said, hey, here are some games that don't exist. They're going to happen. Yeah. And I mean, if Sony did that, we'd be laughing for weeks. We'd be like, what the fuck is wrong with you, you dumbasses?
By the way, we're making an Uncharted game for PS4. It's going to come out, just so you know.
It's funny, James, because I think those of us who... I mean, we literally talk about Nintendo every single week for at least 2 hours. I think those of us who are a little closer to it, a little more used to it, are probably a little more cool-headed about that stuff. Because we're more realistic, and we're also just guarded in a very reasonable way, I think, which is to say, actually, why don't you show me something real? Rather than tell me about what you want to do. And then I'll get really excited and I'll be authentically excited. And I'm going to keep an open mind all the way up until the point that you actually show the real thing. I'm not going to freak out now and then a month later decide, oh, that was silly.
So, I mean, if you remember our conversation about that Nintendo Direct, you and I both kind of went off at the same time, which is when that, that Project X trailer started.
Well, right? Like everything up to that point was, yeah, okay, sure, cool. Then that came on. I was like, oh, shit.
Yeah, I was following it on Twitter, and then it's like it's video playing. It looks like Xenoblade and HD. I'm like, oh, fuck. And then it's like, he got it in the back. I'm like, oh, my God, I changed my pants. Like, and that was the point, because it was, I mean, it was real. It was a thing. There was material about it that could be touched, could be felt, could be experienced.
Also, you and I have played Xenoblade. I think, you know, a lot of people in the gaming media did not, because it was a Wii game released in 2012.
Yeah, but they should have, because it's amazing.
Yeah.
But, oh,
yeah,
I mean, obviously. I think there was enough presence in the gaming media that did play it that understood the ramifications of that trailer. But, I mean, they were getting a lot of credit for, like, oh, they're going to remake Wind Waker. Yeah, Wind Waker is a masterpiece. Wind Waker is a game that, if you play it now on a GameCube, on an SD TV, still looks unfucking believable.
Yeah.
Wind Waker is one of the pinnacles of art design in gaming history, if not the absolute peak that art design has ever achieved in a game.
And yet, the stuff that they showed of this remake, you weren't even all that impressed with it.
No, I was like, what the fuck is this? They look like toys.
Case in point.
And, but, I mean, some members of the general media lost their minds.
I don't even think they watched it. I think they just heard about it. I think the very idea of it excites them, and they didn't even bother to look at what was actually shown, which was not – they didn't actually show anything, by the way. It was total – it's just concept
art. Sony said, we're remaking Dark Cloud 2 for the PS4, people are like, okay, who the fuck cares? Fuck you.
Dark Cloud 2 is a good game.
They would think somebody got into Sony's press account and was releasing fake press releases. Here's some pictures. They'd be like, no, dumbasses.
And Squaresoft.
We really actually have to wrap up the show now. So thanks everybody who wrote in, and we are always looking for more emails, and maybe we'll even get to some next week. You can send your letters, questions, ideas, comments, feedback to rfn@nintendoworldreport.com. Also wanted to remind you that there's a new episode of the Famicast. It came out a few days ago. Now, if you're a subscriber to RFN, you should already have a copy of this episode. But if you're not a subscriber, you might want to head over to Nintendo World Report and find it there. Or just look us up in iTunes and subscribe, and you can go back and get it very easily. But I know that that show kicks off with Danny talking about Dragon Quest VII, the 3DS remake. So I haven't heard it yet. I'm very excited to go listen to that part, at least. And I'm sure there's a lot more good stuff on there, too. Speaking of other podcasts, I recorded a bonus episode or a bonus segment for Connectivity about space with Scott Thompson. And I think that's going to be out probably the day before or the same day as this episode launches. So by the time you hear this, you should be able to get it. If you're not already subscribed to Connectivity, you can do that very easily, or head over to the website and download it there. But it'll be at the end of the episode, the part about space. And it's the second time we've done it. Super fun. So again, people send in questions for that, and I appreciate them doing that. And I hope people check it out. It's about half an hour long, and it's all about space. So I hope you'll check that out. And also this week, we just recorded and released the 50th, very special 50th anniversary of Box Office Poison, which is the movie podcast I'm on with Carl and Obi and Stan and John Rend over there on Crosstalk. And this is, I think, the best episode we've ever done. It's well over 3 hours long, and we talk about our top five movies of all time. And it's super fun. So I hope you'll check that out sometime. It's a really good episode.
You've done 50 episodes of that, and you still haven't done Titanic 2, The Legend Lives On. Are you serious?
Is that a real thing?
That is a real thing. It is an Italian cartoon masterpiece.
I just can't believe that for half an hour you guys were debating if Mighty Ducks 1 or 2 was at the top of your top 5.
It's all about the Lady Killers, gentlemen.
Oh, man. Oh, man. No, but the Coens do make an appearance. I'll say that.
not for that movie. They better not.
No, not for the Lady Killers. So anyway, you can find Box Office Poison on iTunes. Just do a search for it or go to crosstalk.com with a W. And finally, I wanted to announce the winner of our retroactive poll. It was actually a very tight race in at least two ways. Usually there were at least three games very, very close through most of the voting, and it didn't really start to spread out until the very last day. But winning by two or three votes was Ease Book 1 and 2, the Turbo CD game that's available on Virtual Console. There's also a remake of it on Nintendo DS, and there are new remakes of it on Steam. I might check those out as well. I've played a little bit of it, talked about it a long time ago on the podcast. It's a really fun game. It's, I know people are complaining, another RPG. This is not really an RPG.
No,
okay.
It's not.
It's more of an action game. It's similar to Zelda, but it's also very different from Zelda in some really interesting ways. And it has amazing CD quality, looping butt rock soundtrack, very reminiscent of Lords of Thunder, so as only a Turbo CD game can have.
And people are asking, the ones that aren't complaining, are asking which is the version to get. I think some of the differences are the DS version is not to be recommended from what I remember from reviews.
Yeah, it's a very dodgy version of the game.
You know, the VC version is the Turbo... Yeah, so it's a Turbo CD release, and it's supposed to be excellent, and yeah. It does have its quirks, though. Like, this is a very much, like, kind of a Zelda-like game, except that the hero basically bumps with his swords sticking out into enemies. Mm-hmm. Yep. Like, you don't swing your sword. So that is one oddity that I find interesting, and that, that's the version that I'm gonna choose. But then the version on Steam has reworked graphics, but also is more, has more traditional gameplay.
Yeah.
So push a button to swing the sword like in Zelda.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
There we go.
So anyway, any of the above are valid. In fact, if you have one of these other versions other than the original on Virtual Console, let us know, because I'd be very interested in hearing your thoughts, and maybe we can talk about the comparisons and the differences among the different versions. Anyway, it's a very fun game. If you've never tried an Ease game before, it's pretty easy to get into. It's a challenging game, but it's not difficult to understand by any means, and it's really interesting. So I think it's a good winner. The second place was Zombies Ate My Neighbors, and followed up in third by, well, I think the third place was Star Tropics 2, actually. And the race was so close that probably both of those games, I will stick in a second chance poll, eventually once we get around to doing that. So I think those games will have another chance at retroactive in the future because they did get a lot of votes. But anyway, the winner is Ease Book 1 and 2. I hope you will try it, even if you didn't vote for it, even if you didn't vote at all. I think it's going to be really fun. It's a very easy to find game, and we're going to be talking about it in a few weeks. So there will be a forum thread set up to, this is a normal retroactive, not like the live show. So we're going to have a forum thread set up for people to talk about it and leave comments. We're going to pull those in and use them when we talk about it on the show. So I will have that set up by the time this episode goes out, and you will find a link to it in the show notes over at NintendoWorldReport.com. That's all for this week. Thank you everyone for listening, and we'll talk to you next time.
Plugs, Ed.
Later.
Good night.